On March the 5th, 1948, President Harry Truman scribbled a hasty note to the State Department over the mounting crisis in Germany.
Will Russia move first? Who pulls the trigger? Then where do we go?
A fortnight later, the president delivered a special message to Congress asking for peacetime conscription.
It is of vital importance that we keep our occupation forces in Germany until the peace is secure in Europe. We must be prepared to pay the price for peace, or assuredly we shall pay the price of war.
Congress agreed to a peacetime draft, despite a sobering precedent. The only other time this had been done, in 1940, the US went to war little more than a year later. 3 years after the end of the war, in 1948, Germany was still in ruins, its currency worthless. The Soviets kept blocking attempts to revive the German economy. Frustrated, the other three occupying powers, America, Britain and France, introduced a new currency, the Deutschmark, into their zones of Germany. Literally overnight, in June 1948, goods started appearing in the shops. People said it was like Christmas in summer. But Stalin hit back. Although Berlin was occupied by all four allies, it lay deep in the Soviet zone of occupation in eastern Germany. America, Britain and France had to cross Soviet-controlled territory in order to reach their sectors of the city. So Stalin closed off all access to Berlin by rail, road and river. The Western presence in the city seemed almost untenable, but General Lucius Clay insisted that there were larger issues at stake.
We are convinced that our remaining in Berlin is essential to our prestige in Germany and in Europe. Whether for good or bad, it has become a symbol of the American intent.
Truman agreed, and George Marshall, the Secretary of State, sent a crisp cable to London summarizing the new U.S. policy.
1. We stay in Berlin. 2. We will supply the city by air as a beleaguered garrison. Also, we and the British and French, if possible, should send a note to the Soviets asserting our rights in Berlin and stressing Soviet responsibility for and callousness to threatened starvation of the civilian population. We see an advantage in keeping the Berlin situation before world attention by every feasible device. We are hopeful that war can be avoided by these means.
This was a very big hope. Many commentators believed it impossible to keep 2 million people supplied by air. But the US and Britain mounted what the Americans called Operation Vittles.
To date, until 4 o'clock this afternoon, Berlin time, American planes alone brought in more than 21,000 tons.
Against the odds, the airlift continued all through the winter. At its height, planes were landing in Berlin every 30 seconds.
We'll keep on flying as much as possible into Berlin so long as it is necessary. We haven't reached capacity yet.
They carried vital food, coal, and clothing. But non-essentials mattered as much for people's morale. As Gail Halverson, a young U.S. pilot, discovered when he met some children in Berlin.
After about 1 hour, I noticed something was missing. Those kids hadn't begged for a single thing. So I told them to be down at the end of the runway next day, and I dropped them some gum and candy. That night, I tied up some candy bars and gum in handkerchiefs and had my chief sling them out on a signal from me next day. Day by day, the crowd of kids waiting for the drop got bigger, and day by day, my supply of handkerchiefs, old shirts, GI sheets, and old shorts, all of which I use for parachutes, gets smaller.
Halverson became famous in the German media as the chocolate flyer, and other pilots followed his lead. So what started as a human gesture became brilliant PR. In fact, the airlift, or air bridge, as Berliners called it, helped transform America from enemy to friend in the minds of millions of Germans. One U.S. Air Force officer remarked,
"Seems to me I've met every German in Berlin. They come down here clutching extremely valuable heirlooms against their breasts, and they want to make a little ceremony of giving the stuff to the pilots. It's no act, either. An old man, so thin you could see through him, showed up a few days ago with a watch that would have fed him for months on the black market. He insisted on giving it to an American. He called it a little token from an old and grateful heart.
The German people swarm around the edge of the fields every day. To them, every plane means not only food and fuel, but a renewed hope of a democratic future.
Although the Soviets could have shot down the planes at any time, they didn't. Stalin's bluff had been called, and he had no desire for war. After nearly a year, in May 1949, the Soviets backed down and lifted the blockade. In a further blow for Stalin, the Truman administration had used the crisis to justify negotiating the North Atlantic Treaty with the countries of Western Europe. At the signing ceremony on April the 4th, 1949, the president stated,
"Men with courage and vision can still determine their own destiny. They can choose slavery or freedom, war or peace. I have no doubt which they will choose. The treaty we are signing here today is evidence of the path they will follow. If there is anything certain today, if there is anything inevitable in the future, it is the will of the people of the world for freedom and for peace."
In the North Atlantic Treaty, all the signatories promised to come to the aid of any member state that was attacked, the kind of commitment lacking in 1914 or 1939. The treaty was a landmark in U.S. foreign policy, the first time the New World had made peacetime commitments to the old. It rounded off a triumphant year for Truman. In 1945, he had stepped into a dead man's shoes when President Franklin Roosevelt was felled by a cerebral hemorrhage, and many Americans felt that those shoes had proved several sizes too big for him. Behind his tough talk, there were many fumbles. In the words of one Washington joke, "To err is Truman." For a while, Truman dithered about whether to run for election in his own right in 1948. He even thought about backing General Ike Eisenhower, now a national hero having commanded the D-Day landings. Truman wrote in his diary,
"I told Ike that he should announce for the nomination on the Democratic ticket and that I'd be glad to be in second place, or vice president. Ike and I could be elected, and my family and myself would be happy outside this great white jail known as the White House."
But eventually Truman did decide to run, and he fought a blistering campaign in 1948, delighted to get out of jail. Crisscrossing the country on a special train and giving fiery populist speeches from the back of the rear coach. He told a crowd at the railroad depot in Dodge City, Kansas,
"In the last few weeks, I have seen, I imagine, about 2.5 million people. I think I have definitely fixed the issues which are before the country now. It is merely the fact. Are the special privilege boys going to run the country, or are the people going to run it? It is up to you to decide."
This image of a little man fighting for the little men of America against big business and special interests captured the national imagination. Against all predictions, Truman won a famous victory in November 1948. But in the autumn of 1949, despite the successes of the Berlin Airlift and the North Atlantic Treaty, Truman's diplomatic record began to look much more vulnerable. On September the 23rd, the president grimly told the American people,
"We have evidence that within recent weeks an atomic explosion occurred in the USSR. Ever since atomic energy was first released by man, the eventual development of this new force by other nations was to be expected. This probability has always been taken into account by us."
Truman was blustering. In fact, U.S. policymakers were privately shaken by evidence of the Soviet atomic test, which they hadn't expected for several more years. The CIA had just told Truman the most probable date was mid-1953. Although it would be some time before the Kremlin had a usable weapon, this test forced a basic rethink of US strategy, which had been based on countering Soviet superiority in conventional forces, troops, tanks and artillery, by the threat of a nuclear attack on the USSR delivered by strategic bombers. Most of these planes were based in Britain and Germany, just a few hundred miles from Soviet territory. Now, however, Stalin would be able to deliver, or at least threaten, atomic retaliation against Western Europe, thereby jeopardizing US strategy and security. While US policymakers were absorbing the shock of the Soviet test, Mao Zedong emerged victorious from China's long civil war. On October 1, 1949, he proclaimed the new People's Republic from the Gate of Heavenly Peace in Beijing. The world's most populous nation was now under communist control. Truman's National Security Council warned somberly,
"The USSR is now an Asiatic power of the first magnitude. If Southeast Asia is also swept by communism, we shall have suffered a major political rout, the repercussions of which will be felt throughout the rest of the world."
So by the spring of 1950, the global outlook seemed much grimmer for American leaders than it had a year earlier. The East was going red, and the West looked decidedly shaky. So Truman now gave the go-ahead to develop a hydrogen bomb, known as the Super because of its massively enhanced power. Pentagon planners, led by Paul Nitze, summed up the situation bleakly for the president as nothing less than a worldwide confrontation between the forces of good and evil.
"The Soviet Union is animated by a new fanatic faith, antithetical to our own, and seeks to impose its absolute authority over the rest of the world. The Kremlin regards the United States as the only major threat to the achievement of its fundamental design. There is a basic conflict between the idea of freedom under a government of laws and the idea of slavery under the grim oligarchy of the Kremlin. The implacable purpose of the slave state to eliminate the challenge of freedom has placed the two great powers at opposite poles."
This apocalyptic language echoed the words of Abraham Lincoln in the 1850s, when he depicted the U.S. as a country half slave and half free. Lincoln had also predicted that America could not remain in that half-and-half state indefinitely. One side would eventually make the other conform to its values. Lincoln was proved right, but at appalling human cost in the Civil War. Now Nitze was using Lincoln's image to describe not just one divided country, but the whole polarized world. The implications in the nuclear age were truly chilling.